You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Solo Acts, with interviews by Kaylin Brody and Britt Hennemuth. Paul Mescal, Normal People. At the top of Paul Mescal's to-do list, once self-quarantine is over, is a visit to his local pub. I recently moved to London and hadn't had a chance to go out before the lockdown was put in place, he says. Until then, the Irish actor, who gives an emotionally raw performance in his screen debut in Normal People, opposite Daisy Edgar-Jones, is trying his best to get the lay of the land. I've taken up running. I find that it clears the mind and helps break up the day. You can't beat that sweet serotonin. Gugu Mbatha-Raw, The Morning Show. This too shall pass, says Gugu Mbatha-Raw from her Los Angeles home. The star of Apple's The Morning Show is adjusting to a quieter period after maintaining the grueling schedule of playing a live television talent booker. I'm taking long baths, meditating. I ordered a mini trampoline online and have been streaming classes with a friend. I've been painting a lot, too. The Renaissance woman promises never to take international travel, the internet, or her health for granted again. In the meantime, she's tuning in to a friend's weekly DJ set on Instagram, offering song suggestions to lift her spirits. Jeremy Pope, Hollywood. The two-time Tony nominee and star of Ryan Murphy's new Netflix series Hollywood is doing his best to keep the beat going. I go from Earth, Wind, and Fire to Drake, and somehow back to the legendary Temptations. It's a quarantined musical journey. When he's not texting with Grandma, this week she learned to use her emojis. He's fantasizing about a closet overhaul inspired by his character Archie's 1940s swag. Pope and his cast are sheltering separately, but are busy promoting the show's release in new ways, via Zoom, live streams, and this at-home photo shoot for Vanity Fair, which turned out to be pretty fun. After the End of the World, a new limited series based on Stephen King's novel The Stand about a global pandemic, was in production just as COVID-19 hit. An exclusive preview of Our Worst Nightmares by Anthony Bresnahan. Opening photo, Force for Good. Whoopi Goldberg as Mother Abigail, the 108-year-old whose followers hold fast to their humanity. Stephen King didn't call his novel The Virus. He didn't call it The Disease, or The End of the World as We Know It, or anything that nihilistic. He wanted his 1978 book about a global pandemic that takes all but a fraction of human life with it to be called The Stand. When there are no rules, his thinking went, survivors have to make a choice. Do you go full Darwin and indulge dark, selfish instincts, or do what's right for the sake of others? I wanted to write about bravery, says King. At some point, people do have to make a stand. The novel remains one of the author's greatest achievements, and a new limited series adaptation, the first since 1994, is headed to CBS All Access later this year in the shadow of an actual global pandemic. Showrunners Benjamin Cavell and Taylor Elmore, who first worked together on Justified, are quick to point out that King layered in reassuring themes, along with the terrifying ones. It's about the fundamental question of what society owes the individual and what we owe to each other, says Cavell. It's hard to know what our world will feel like when The Stand begins its 9-episode run, but the coronavirus pandemic has only intensified interest in movies like Contagion and Outbreak. Next photo, Angels and Devils. Alexander Skarsgård as demonic Randall Flagg. Odessa Young as expectant mother, Franny Goldsmith. The show had to wrap production 4 days early in March when COVID-19 began to shut America down. But as of this writing, the plan is to proceed with the release as scheduled. It was very surreal, obviously, to start to realize that there was a creeping pandemic the way there was at the beginning of our show, Cavell says. Despite parallels that fans have drawn, the disease in The Stand is catastrophically worse than anything we've seen in real life, killing more than 99% of the population. Survivors who are drawn to decency unite around Mother Abigail, played by Whoopi Goldberg, who, over the course of her 108 years, has endured the worst the world has to offer and kept her strength and empathy intact. Her sinister counterpart is a charismatic rockabilly demon named Randall Flagg, played by Alexander Skarsgård. In the ashes of the old world, the new tribes head for a clash that could fulfill the prophecy of Armageddon. First, there's chaos, and then there's reintegration, says King. So it's a question of, do things reintegrate in a way that's good, or do they reintegrate in a way that's Hitlerian and bad? It could go either way, so I wanted to write about that. I wanted to put those two forces in conflict. Among the vast cast of characters is Franny Goldsmith, played by Odessa Young, who discovers she is pregnant just as the disease takes hold. She is immune to the virus, but will her child be too? Franny carries the literal answer to whether life will go on. We do focus very much on that story of Fran and the baby, says Elmore. What are a modern woman's motivations in this position? A 20-year-old kid who is pregnant when the world ends. She's a formidable force in this story. Over his long career, King has made us confront some horrific beginnings. But for every shape-shifting killer clown or crazed father in a desolate hotel, he has modeled optimism and decency. King wrote the final episode of the series himself, adding a coda to his original story that offers hope for some key characters. Over the last however many years, we have sort of taken for granted the structure of democracy, says Cavell. Now, so much of that is being ripped down to the studs. It's interesting to see a story about people who are rebuilding it from the ground up. As Stephen King said, I wanted to write about bravery. At some point, people do have to make a stand. While we're waiting for the next issue of Vanity Fair to arrive, we're going to revisit some articles from past issues. This from April 2020. True Brit. George MacKay helped lead 1917 on a path to glory. Now he's conquering new territory. As interviewed by Britt Hennemuth, with opening photograph by Dario Camesi. After a heroic turn in Sam Mendes' Golden Globe and BAFTA-sweeping World War I drama 1917, the London-bred leading man has Hollywood in the palm of his hands. Already buzzed about for 2016's Sundance standout Captain Fantastic, McKay, 28, stars in True History of the Kelly Gang alongside Russell Crowe in theaters next month, and later opposite Lily Rose Depp in Wolf. Here, some insights gleaned over a Beverly Hills breakfast with Britain's big breakout. His parents are artistically inclined. Mom's a costume designer, Dad was a stage manager, and raised George and his younger sister on theater and ballet. He has ties to Australia, first by his father, who hails from Adelaide, but also as the location for three of his film roles. In True History of the Kelly Gang, he stars as the continent's infamous outlaw, Ned Kelly. He is their Jesse James, or a meaner, more aggro Robin Hood. The film shakes up the perspective of a legend. We explore themes of identity, brutality, and the history of Australia, a place that means a lot to me. He admires the theater background that Mendes brought to the 1917 set, with a luxurious 6 months of rehearsals before the cameras rolled in southern England. It's like a piece of furniture that's been crafted over months, rather than an IKEA one that's just put up. The IKEA one works, but you unconsciously can feel the difference. There's something beautiful about it. Time equals understanding. He read poetry from World War I every morning on set and listened to Tchaikovsky on training runs. Awards season took him out of the trenches and into a Hollywood fantasy. I've been in the same room as Tom Hanks, Meryl Streep, Beyonce, Jay-Z, and it's mad. Even 1917's Best Picture rival left him starstruck. I met Bong Joon-ho. I loved Parasite. The loyal countryman's last used app was for British Airways, and his room service order is porridge. His dream date would be dancing at a blues club in London. As for his eligibility? As he says, that's for me to know.
Thank you.
Back to Blonde. 20 years ago, Joyce Carol Oates published her epic fictional account of Marilyn Monroe's life. Now the story makes a comeback in the hashtag MeToo era by Patricia Bosworth. In the photos, Marilyn Monroe in 1960, the new Echo reissue of Blonde, Joyce Carol Oates in 2018. Long before celebrities could break the internet with bare behinds and pregnancy announcements, Marilyn Monroe laid the groundwork for viral stardom with that photo. The bombshell, perched atop a subway grate, dress billowing up around her shoulders. Though often remembered as candid, it's actually a highly choreographed film still, a glossy, happy image of a woman the world would soon learn was unraveling. 20 years ago, Joyce Carol Oates peeled back that polished veneer with Blonde, the 5-time Pulitzer nominee's fictional account of Monroe's experiences and interior life. The book offered insatiably curious fans a seductive premise, a gritty account of what might have been, rendered in sharp, celluloid clarity. Now, for its 20th anniversary, Blonde comes roaring back with a reissue by Echo and a Brad Pitt-produced Netflix film starring Ana de Armas as Monroe. Readers of Blonde today will recognize the Hollywood moguls whose years of molestation, harassment, abuse, and sexual assault of aspiring actresses were brought to light in 2017, writes critic Elaine Showalter in a new introduction. Blonde now looks more realistic, and its feminist fury stands justified. When Blonde was published in 2000, it was met with the kind of divisive literary fervor that now plays out most aggressively in 280-character tirades. Some critics felt the subject had been dissected enough in biographies by Gloria Steinem and Norman Mailer, Memoir, Monroe's Sister, and countless films, while Michiko Kakutani for The New York Times eviscerated the book's blending of fact and fiction, which she called playing to readers' voyeuristic interest in a real-life story while using the liberties of a novel to tart up the facts. But others described Blonde as scary and rhapsodic, and epic and impressionistic, and it went on to garner nominations for the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize that year. In recent years, controversy has followed Oates to Twitter, which the 81-year-old has taken to with her characteristic prolificity. She's drawn sharp criticism for tweets that have been perceived as xenophobic or elitist or both. As I write this, the award-winning author of 58 novels and thousands of short stories, essays, and reviews is debating the erotic origins of Dracula. The most powerful writing, Oates says in her masterclass on the short story, comes from confronting taboos. Oates achieved this in Blonde, drawing on the preoccupations, sexual violence perpetrated against women, and all that is shameful and lonely about female adolescence that haunt many of her greatest novels. Foxfire, Confessions of a Girl Gang, We Were the Mulvaneys, Rape, A Love Story. This may be why the best parts of Blonde are when Oates zeroes in on the young Monroe and her time spent in orphanages and with adults who couldn't or shouldn't care for her. Never can you climb over this wall, Blonde's protagonist tells herself. You're not strong enough. Your body is for others, not for you. Oates began reimagining the icon's life after discovering a blurry snapshot of her at 15 years old, smiling radiantly, vacantly, poignantly into the camera. She looks like girls I went to high school with, the Lockport, New York native has said. The bones of Monroe's life, a glittering Hollywood career, a drug dependency, three failed marriages, hopeless attempts to become a mother, humiliating sex with a president, and death at age 36, enthralled to Oates' prodigious imagination, render a near-mythic story in flesh and blood. State's Red Pill. For years, State Department official Matthew Gebert's white nationalism was a secret. Then he was outed. By Peter Savodnik. Opening photo, members of the Shield Wall Network, an Arkansas-based neo-Nazi group, celebrate the birthday of American Nazi Party founder George Rockwell in March 2019. It probably started with an ex-cop. They're usually ex-cops, asking him questions about extramarital affairs, credit card debt, aliases, weekend getaways to ex-Soviet backwaters, anything that could have been used against him. The ex-cop probably didn't know a lot about the job Matthew Gebert was applying for. The officials Gebert would brief, the top secret information Gebert would have access to. Nor was he a reader of souls. His job was simply to ascertain whether the answers on the standard form, or SF-86, that Gebert had filled out were true. Whatever his background, he was a part-time employee of a contractor hired by the Department of State's Bureau of Diplomatic Security to process security clearances. He was probably padding his pension. It was probably this, or Uber. Diplomatic Security signed off. Gebert was smart. He had recently been awarded a Presidential Management Fellowship, according to an alumni news update in GW Magazine. He was a future leader. Months elapsed. One day, an email arrived in his inbox. Gebert had been offered a job at the State Department's Bureau of Energy Resources. He became a civil service officer. He reported to important people, deputy secretaries, political appointees, and these people reported to really important people. He attended meetings about the economic sanctions imposed on Iran and international oil flows, and making sure the Russians or Indians don't F us, as one former diplomat put it. His job, like those of his colleagues, was to advance the national interest. It was 2013. Gebert's life was practically a caricature of a life people used to live. He was in his early 30s. He and his wife, Anna Gebert, née Vukovic, blonde, of Serbian extraction, owned a 5-bedroom, 3.5-bath neo-colonial at the end of a cul-de-sac in a planned community called Greenway Farms. In the sprawling epicenter of planned communities that was Northern Virginia, government contractors, engineers, ex-military, Stepfordish. He had a baby, then two more. His patch of lawn was always mowed. His kids made friends with other kids, rode bikes, attended a nearby school. When his son Alex was born at Inova Luden Hospital, the Stanley Cup happened to be in the house. A Washington Capitals coach lived in the neighborhood, and for 90 minutes, the 3-foot-tall, 34-pound silver chalice made the rounds, local media reported at the time. Gebert asked if he could put Alex in there for a pic, and with a nod from the coach, his son, who was literally one day old, was napping in the Stanley Cup. American dream realized. At Foggy Bottom, at Greenway Farms, he was just Matthew Q. Gebert. Boring, dad, government dude, one of his colleagues said. People described him as friendly, straight-laced. He wasn't one to socialize outside of normal work hours, according to colleagues. He usually left early. He had an hour and a half commute home. But that was only half of Gebert. The other half was a secret, and for several years it stayed that way. 2 years into his job at the State Department, Gebert started dabbling in the alt-right. The loosely knit constellation of white nationalist and white supremacist who constitute some of the president's fringiest supporters. Eventually, he became a fixture in the alt-right scene, reportedly running a local chapter called the D.C. Helicopter Pilots, according to Southern Poverty Law Center blog Hate Watch, in an apparent allusion to the late Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet, whose supporters were known to throw political opponents out of helicopters. In those circles, Gebert was known mostly as Coach Finstock. It was an odd pseudonym. Coach Finstock was a character on the MTV series Teen Wolf, and he was played by Orny Adams, a Jewish comedian. Among his acolytes, he was just Coach. He mostly played the role of Denfather for 20-something latchkey haters. The former alt-right provocateur Katie McHugh, who last year publicly denounced the movement, is said to have crashed at the Gibberts' house for several weeks. McHugh did not respond to a request for comment. Anna Gibbert served on the board of a local tourism association, Visit Loudoun, while complaining privately that Loudoun County was becoming too diverse, according to a Washington Post column. The couple reportedly served swastika cookies to like-minded guests. Gibbert's evolution happened slowly, and then all at once. He grew up in the Democratic stronghold of Stratford, New Jersey. Race didn't appear to be a big deal, at least not openly. There was some gang violence, but heroin was a bigger problem, according to a source. Gibbert was a standout. He read, traveled to Ukraine and Russia, and studied in Moscow through a program at American University. He acquired an affection for all things Slavic. He met his wife, who was studying abroad through Northwestern University, according to Hate Watch. In 2015, Gibbert escaped the conservative reservation, as he reportedly put it. In a 2018 appearance on a podcast hosted by alt-right figure Ricky Vaughn, speaking as Coach Finstock, he traced his shift to the immigration bill co-sponsored by John McCain and Ted Kennedy. "That was sort of what got my wheels turning," was McCain-Kennedy in 2006, when they were trying to do that amnesty, as I saw MS-13 proliferating throughout Virginia. In 2015-2016, everything started to coalesce, both online and off. Donald Trump, the wall, the obvious passions and furies the Republican nominee was tapping into, the fecklessness and hypocrisy of GOP leadership. In alt-right parlance, Gibbert was red-pilled. Alt-righters may present better than run-of-the-mill bigots, but their beliefs are hardly sophisticated. They subscribe to the same anti-Semitic mythologies that have been coursing through the ether for centuries. But because they read newspapers and have a glancing familiarity with big ideas, they sound credible to those on the precipice, those in search of an identity. Gibbert is believed to have socialized with leading alt-right figures like Richard Spencer and Michael Painovich. Spencer, in 2016 and 2017, was best known as the face of the movement. Painovich, who goes by the name Michael Enoch, founded the alt-right blog and podcast network The Right Stuff. Painovich, in a rambling telephone conversation, denied having heard of Gibbert, despite reports of Gibbert hosting Painovich at his home. Gibbert, like Spencer and Painovich, was in Charlottesville in August 2017 for the Unite the Right rally that left one protester dead, his brother Michael Gibbert told Hate Watch. In 2018, he reportedly donated $225 to the Republican congressional candidate Paul Neelan, best known for his anti-Semitism. According to a complaint of discrimination, one of Gibbert's colleagues filed against him with the State Department's Office of Civil Rights. Gibbert debated the pros and cons of Charlottesville in an online post just after the rally. "Dude, we smacked the hornet's nest with a big effing stick. The only question is whether this is valuable accelerationism or whether we just provoked the Red Guards, like a year before we had enough time to spare." The complaint also cites one of Gibbert's now-deleted tweets, posted under his Coach Finstock alias, which featured a photograph of Nazi soldiers forming a massive swastika while carrying torches, with the caption, "It's that time, again." Sources told me the complaint was dismissed, largely on First Amendment grounds. Several months before Gibbert tweeted the swastika photograph, he appeared on Vaughn's podcast to, in his words, defend the movement, to defend my friends. Vaughn, whose given name is Douglas Mackey, has come under attack from fellow alt-righters for not being adequately alt-right. Not long after the podcast aired, Nealon, the Republican congressional candidate, doxed him, sending Vaughn's life into a tailspin. Gebert was angry with Vaughn for sowing discord among the movement. He said more than once that it was important to name the Jew alt-right speak for using openly anti-Semitic terms. Next photo, Matthew Gebert wore sunglasses to the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. Vaughn said Ann Coulter and Tucker Carlson were susceptible to Zionist propaganda, which Gebert appeared to agree with. But then Gebert said, the service that Tucker is doing on Fox News is unquestionably of value to the boomers sitting in their lazy boys and watching it every night and dropping those bombs. At one point in the conversation, Gebert turned somber. He was discussing his double life. I take these risks because I have a grave sense of foreboding that this country and all of the white countries on earth are on a collision course with perdition, with disaster, he said. The only reason I'm taking this risk is so that my kids can grow up in a whiter country. In 2018, Gebert's security clearance, a top-secret, sensitive, compartmented information clearance, which gave him access to an array of highly sensitive intelligence across the U.S. government, was renewed. None of these interviews ever, I would say, was an impressive human being. But this was truly unbelievable, one of Gebert's former colleagues said. Another former colleague added, how could you not connect the dots? I attempted many times to reach out to Gebert for comment, first through email, then through a phone number I believed to be his, then through his family members, none of whom replied. I tried knocking on his door and leaving my contact information with a neighbor, all to no avail. For years, Gebert took a combination of trains and buses into D.C., went to work, came home, logged on. He and his wife were model neighbors. They could be relied on in a pinch for sugar or milk. I've had Nazi milk, one neighbor said. Jesus, to think of that. They adhered to the homeowners association bylaws and painted their house one of the colors in the Duron curb appeal approved exterior accent palette, in this case wheat, or maybe amber white with forest green trim. None of the neighbors I spoke to disliked him. Then, on the morning of August 7, 2019, Hate Watch reported that Gebert was the leader of an alt-right cell in Northern Virginia and that he had posted anti-Semitic comments on white nationalist forums and been a guest on a now-defunct podcast called The Fatherland, which addressed issues like white demographic decline and the subversiveness of girl power. Within minutes, the story was being read on most of the screens in the building, a State Department employee said. It didn't take long for the story to start ping-ponging around the globe, from one U.S. embassy to another. As far as the higher-ups at State were concerned, there were two big problems with Gebert being a civil service officer. The first was that his unmasking had made him repugnant and toxic. The second was Russia. Multiple State Department sources suggested that Gebert's apparent affinity for Slavic culture, particularly as related to his white nationalist leanings, would be considered problematic. He was, no surprise, against the Iran sanctions, in large part, former colleagues speculated, because Russia was too. He worked with people involved in the Iran sanctions, said Alex Call, who worked with Gebert at the Bureau of Energy Resources. When you do these negotiations and you have large teams, you have to use the same email listserv, and that goes on the top secret system. He would have been watching the whole strategy discussion. Remember, our goal was reducing Iranian crude oil exports, removing those barrels from the market, but maintaining market stability. Matt was privy to all these discussions. We engaged the buyers of Iranian crude oil and worked with them to reduce demand, Call said. Sumat would have understood, for example, Indian purchases of Iranian crude oil. We look at this as a whole ecosystem, so we make sure that everybody knows what everybody else is doing, connecting dots. He had access to all that information. That, Call said, is concerning. Anyone who's a white nationalist is not an American patriot. Amos Hochstein, who was appointed Deputy Assistant Secretary of State by Barack Obama in 2011 and oversaw the Bureau of Energy Resources for part of the time Gebert was there, could recall being in many meetings with Gebert. I think that Gebert is a symptom, and he's a warning sign because he got careless, said Hochstein, who is an Orthodox Jew. The idea that there's only one white nationalist neo-Nazi rising in the ranks of the national security establishment is difficult to imagine. He said that Gebert had been polite, capable. He said he had tried to help him professionally, because that was good for Gebert and for America. I shook his hand on, I have no idea how many times, his shoulder rubbed up against mine when we were in meetings, you know, when you're next to someone. I think about that a lot. About an hour after the Hate Watch story went live, Gebert emailed two of his superiors about what he characterized as a hit piece, according to a source, and said he was leaving for the day. Soon after, his name was scrubbed from state's phone directory. Investigations at state, at the FBI, and on Capitol Hill were launched. He is believed to be on unpaid leave. According to a source, he has not been on payroll since at least October. As the fallout from the story reverberated, there was a sense among the alt-right that Gebert had been sloppy and maybe naive. Greg Johnson, the editor of white nationalist publishing house Countercurrents, which both Matthew and Anna Gebert, under their respective aliases, had written for and which is based in San Francisco, said in an email that Gebert was an intelligent, educated, racially aware white man, but that he had fallen in with an East Coast set that followed Spencer, unserious and trashy people, flakes, drunks, drug abusers, women haters, and embittered, used-up groupies. Over the years, Johnson and Spencer have sparred. A lot of the conflict, according to alt-writers, had to do with personal style. Spencer became the best-known face of the frat style, polos and chinos alt-right. Johnson has dispensed with such pretenses. But the tension also underscored a debate about how best to save America from itself. In Johnson's view, the far right had to win the war of ideas before it could move on to the real world battlefield. That meant books and articles, speaking engagements, conferences, symposia. He had a way of explaining things that made racism and Jew hatred sound like post-structuralism or supply-side economics, something that was once new or avant-garde or even suspect and, over time, acquired a large following. Spencer was more of a would-be Vladimir Lenin. He wanted to be in the middle of things. He had pondered a congressional campaign in Montana, where he usually lived. He felt let down by Trump. His administration is not fundamentally different than a Mitt Romney administration, or even a Hillary Clinton administration, Spencer said in an interview. I never expected him to be me, but I expected him to do something. The feeling on the alt-right was that Charlottesville was a disaster because it fragmented the movement. For Spencer, political outcomes mattered. Both Johnson and Spencer, having been open about their white nationalism, seemed resigned to the ostracism that came with it. Gebert was not that. He was like most alt-righters, especially those who wore a suit to work and had colleagues who weren't white men. He didn't want to be found out. He wore sunglasses to Charlottesville. He reportedly had a rotating cast of anonymous handles, at Total War Coach, at Unbowed Coach, at Risen Coach. He built a life for himself and his family around the same kind of mainstream institutions that Johnson and Spencer spurned, and he didn't want to give that up. He wanted white nationalism and his security clearance. This didn't sit right with Spencer. Gebert's downfall, he told me, is a lesson on how to be a fellow traveler. You can't do dissident revolutionary politics in your spare time or for fun. Gebert's neighbors were mostly shocked. When the story broke, Gebert was on the board of the Greenway Farms Homeowners Association and until recently had been its president. Soon after, Peter Fetters, who lives in Greenway Farms, organized a Hate Has No Home Here lawn sign campaign. The HOA bylaws bar lawn signs, but the association's board of directors made an exception. So Fetters ordered 200 signs. Signs run $25 apiece if you buy them individually, but $5 if you get 100 or more, and according to another neighbor, through a distribution party at the park that Gebert, as president, had helped create. When I stopped by the Gebert house in January, a gray-white cat loitered near the door. No one appeared to be home. I was later told that someone at Greenway Farms had texted Anna a photo of me knocking on doors. By mid-afternoon, yellow buses were dropping off kids. At around 4 p.m., outside lights came on automatically, and about an hour later, commuters started coming home, but not the Geberts. Recently, there was a Gebert sighting, which created a minor furor on the neighborhood Facebook page. One resident, Brandon Miller, posted, "FYI, everyone's favorite Nazi white supremacist, Matthew Gebert, was taking a stroll this afternoon taking pictures of certain houses." Miller included the number of the Leesburg police just in case. Obviously not illegal, but just be advised. Other residents wondered whether Gebert was singling out houses that had put up lawn signs. Some board members speculated that Gebert was taking pictures of comparables, real estate jargon for houses valued similarly to his own. Fetters thought that might be the case. Gebert, he said, had requested HOA documents from the management company, which he said is typically a sign that a homeowner might sell. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.